Welcome to Scope It Out with Dr. Tim Smith. In this episode, Dr. Smith speaks with Dr. Sandra Lin, Associate Professor at Johns Hopkins University. They will discuss the article, Primary Immunodeficiency and Recalcitrant Chronic Rhinosinusitis. This edition of Scope It Out is sponsored by an educational grant from Intersect ENT, developers of the Propel Mometasone Furoate Sinus Implant. Propel is the only FDA-approved, bioabsorbable implant designed to prop open the post-surgical ethmoid sinus and gradually deliver an advanced corticosteroid directly to the sinus lining over 30 days. Propel is clinically proven to improve post-operative outcomes by reducing the need for additional surgical procedures and systemic steroids, and is the only product in sinus surgery backed by level 1A clinical evidence. Please visit www.propelopens.com for further information.
Hello, hello everyone, and welcome to Scope It Out. I'm your host, Tim Smith, and I'm joined today by Sandra Lin, who is an associate professor at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Lin recently has published a study entitled Primary Immunodeficiency and Recalcitrant Chronic Rhinosinusitis. It's a systematic review. It's available in early view for the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. So, Sandra, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. You know, I thought this was a good topic to talk about because it's something that I certainly struggle with in terms of, you know, which patients should I be screening and testing for these immunodeficiencies, and what do we know about surgical outcomes in this particular patient population? So I'm excited to hear some of your findings. Maybe you could just summarize what you think are the most important and clinically relevant findings of your study.
Sure. Well, I think one important thing to know for all of us who see patients with chronic rhinosinusitis in our practices is that in the 39 articles that met the criteria for our systematic review, the range was 10 to 54% of these patients had primary immune deficiency.
That's just crazy that up to 54% of patients could have these primary immunodeficiencies. In that particular article, or in the articles with a higher proportion of patients, are they sub-selecting some super recalcitrant group?
I think also what may be skewing it, not just the sub-selection, is, you know, of course, most of these articles are coming from tertiary centers in which they are the super recalcitrant patients, which are already selected out.
Right.
So I think if you're a community-based otolaryngologist, I think it's less likely that you'd be seeing higher numbers. And in my personal experience, even at a tertiary center, I would say that 54% is very high. But I think in a community-based practice, you are not going to be seeing numbers like this. Just the nature of these publications and where these patients, you know, these are patients who go to the tertiary centers, which may have had problems for long periods of time and seen multiple specialists. So I think that really skews to, you know, one side when we're looking at the publications.
You found that this incredibly high proportion of patients, potentially selection bias at play here, but higher than any of us would really think about, are potentially affected by this. What other findings from the study ring true?
Some of the findings that are interesting to us, particularly as, you know, how to improve the outcomes or looking at surgical outcomes, actually, is that we do see in these patients who are diagnosed with primary immune deficiency, they respond in a similar fashion to those without primary immune deficiency in the adult population to endoscopic sinus surgery. That's really important for us when we counsel patients who have immunodeficiency when they're going to have surgery. We'll say, you know, you're going to have similar response rates to patients who don't have immunodeficiency. However, when we looked at the literature, it's not so clear cut as far as consensus in the effectiveness of endoscopic sinus surgery in the pediatric population with primary immunodeficiency.
So if we focus on adults when we're counseling them, based on your understanding of the literature, we could counsel an adult patient who has some type of immunodeficiency that they're going to have similar outcomes of surgery that someone without immunodeficiency, and by outcome, I guess you're meaning improvement in quality of life.
Yes, I think that improvement in quality of life and symptoms, so yes.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Do they continue to have more infections, more exposures to antibiotics and things like that?
Of course, the endoscopic sinus surgery is helpful, but it's not going to correct the underlying immunodeficiencies. I think that one thing that's important in my clinical practice is to make sure that an immunologist with a lot of experience in managing primary immunodeficiency is managing that component. Because for us to have good outcomes, we have to have not only a good surgery, but really excellent management. For example, there's sometimes where patients who are already diagnosed refer to me from an immunologist with this problem, and we're talking about their issues, and if you know, they say, I'm having more and more sinus infections, and I've probably seen them and really confirmed in my mind that these are bacterial sinus infections and not just upper respiratory viral infections where I really see that they're true bacterial. One of the things I ask the patient is, has there been a change in your immune supplementation regimen? Sometimes what I find is that the patients are going too long in between, and if the immunologist makes some adjustments to have immunoglobulin replacement therapy a little more frequently, like one shorter time period by 1 week, these patients are not having the problem. So, I mean, I think your point is really great. You know, surgery, yes, we expect similar outcomes, but the underlying disease process has to help. We need help with the immunologist to control that as well.
Did you learn anything in the course of this that has changed the way you practice?
Well, one of the things I think is that first thing that I stated is I'm wondering if I'm underdiagnosing people with primary immunodeficiency that are recalcitrant to medical therapy. Although I'll have to say that I don't routinely test every patient who has this problem, but what typically skews me to start testing for immunodeficiency are patients where I see real endoscopic evidence of bacterial infection and having to have really frequent antibiotics. Then I start thinking about doing testing. From doing this study, I think that perhaps I was not being liberal enough with those patients that I included for testing in the past.
And what testing would you order specifically? If you had the question and the patient sitting in front of you in the office, what tests would you order?
According to what we found in the literature, the testing that's recommended is to draw serum immunoglobulin levels, IgG subclass levels, and a functional antibody response to the pneumococcal vaccines pre and post-vaccination. So on discussion with my immunologist here at Hopkins, what he's instructed me to do is really, he said that, you know, draw the serum immunoglobulin levels. He doesn't even recommend drawing the IgG subclass levels. He said it would be extremely rare for a patient not to have some decrease just in the total serum immunoglobulin levels. However, if we look at
the total,
yeah, the IgG, total IgG, yeah, IAME and IgG. And that's what my immunologist likes us to draw here. But as I said, according to the literature that we pulled for this systematic review, they're recommending the serum immunoglobulin levels in addition to that IgG subclasses and then the pneumococcal vaccine response titers pre and post vaccination.
So you're at a referral center. What proportion of your patients are you checking these on? Just a guesstimate.
Guesstimate. Maybe 15%.
15%, okay.
Maybe
okay.
20.
One in five, one in six patients. Are you checking anybody before they have surgery, or are you only checking people who've already had surgery and now they've failed? Still struggling.
Right. I actually will do both sometimes. But I think the first thing to differentiate is, you know, really, as I mentioned earlier, are they really having true bacterial infections? As we know, a lot of patients think they're having sinus infections and they're really having viral. So if I suspect that's the case for the patient, I really instruct them to say, next time you have an exacerbation, let me know. I'll squeeze you into my next clinic because I want to look in there and take a culture. It may take a few times where I've seen the patient and been like, wow, yeah, every time, you know, twice they've been here a month or 6 weeks apart and it's been positive despite having appropriate treatment from the prior episode. Those are the types of things which would really push me to suspect primary immunodeficiency. In addition, what we also see is that patients with chronic ear infections and lung disease such as recurrent pneumonias should add increased suspicion to having a primary immunodeficiency. So those are the types of questions, you know, we should also be screening our sinusitis patients.
So if I saw a patient come in and they'd not had surgery before and they had, let's say, recurrent episodes of sinusitis, and they also have a history of recurrent pulmonary infections and recurrent, you know, otitis, for instance, to me, that's kind of a no-brainer. You got to check immunoglobulins on that patient.
Right.
But I have to say, I probably don't ever check immunoglobulins on someone who has not already had surgery and is struggling even after sinus surgery. Do you think I'm missing? I mean, I'm missing some there, but should I change my practice?
It's a hard thing to know what you're missing. If we want to believe what we found in these studies, if you screened everybody with a calcitonin, I think the 54% is too high. It's probably closer to the 10%. You may be missing some patients. On the negative side is if we screen everyone, it's increases the health, you know, there's probably going to be eight or nine patients that we have subjected to a test that's not going to yield a positive result. I think it's a difficult thing to say.
Yeah.
Then arguing on the plus side for testing is some of these people will be previously undiagnosed, and if we can intervene early, perhaps can prevent potential pulmonary issues like bronchiectasis that might develop if they continue to be untreated and have other lung infections. I think what's hard to say is the hard and fast. A lot of it, it's really still to the discretion of the practitioner in some ways, and this is where I feel like medicine is still sometimes a bit of an art, and just like teasing out some of the details, really be diligent looking if they're really having infections may push you more on that one patient. Other practitioners, I'm sure, at tertiary centers screen everybody. So, I think it sounds like you and I are somewhere in between. Yeah,
I definitely know that there are those folks out there who are literally screening everyone, and they, you know, it's their opinion that it really changes the way they practice in these patients. So let's talk phenotype a little bit. So I have this bias in my head about thinking about what these patients look like. They are the non-polyp patient with recurrent bacterial infections. They might have chronic disease, but it's non-polyp disease, but they almost look more like the recurrent acute rhinosinusitis patient. Was that borne out in the literature?
We had a total of 39 studies, and of the studies, only three had a subgroup analysis for patients with polyps, and there was no statistical association. So that means 36 of these studies were in patients with non-polypoid patients. So you're correct. It's those patients who have some chronic disease, non-polypoid, but having bacterial exacerbations. Absolutely. Yeah.
And in my practice, what I really have seen, I feel like they almost look more like the recurrent acute rhinosinusitis than they do the chronic rhinosinusitis, meaning they may completely clear between these episodes, but suffer multiple repeated episodes of acute bacterial rhinosinusitis over the course of the year.
I'm in absolute agreement.
Does that hold true?
Yeah, I'm in agreement. So one of the things you're asking about, who should I be testing? Now, if you have a practice that is largely chronic polypoid patients, I'm thinking that you're yield, if you were to test every single patient, might be lower because you're right. That is not the typical presentation of a primary immunodeficiency patient.
Okay, but it's interesting because if we look at this group with polyposis, they, you know, half of them have asthma or lower airway disease, so, and they might get bronchitis and pulmonary infections related to that. So now you're looking at this patient. They have recalcitrant disease because they have recurrent polyposis despite multiple surgeries. They also have airway disease and bronchitis. Should we be testing them as well, do you think?
Well, I think that, in my opinion, that those patients have good response to medications that treat inflammation like prednisone, budesonide irrigations, which is not the case for those patients with the primary immunodeficiency. I think that saline irrigations may be helpful in those patients with primary immunodeficiency, and I think that's where some of these patients, even with the nasal polyps and the asthma, if you really can control the inflammation, including the lower airway disease, I think that really pushes you more towards they're really inflammatory as opposed to recurrent infectious.
The other thing that I'm commonly thinking about in my practice is I look for other types of infections like otitis or like bronchitis to help steer me towards those patients who might have immunodeficiency.
Right.
Is that reliable clinical screen, do you think? Or are there patients who really their problem is recurrent rhinosinusitis and recalcitrant rhinosinusitis, but they're not showing these other forms of infection. They still have an immunodeficiency. What are your thoughts on that?
What we do know is when we looked at these papers that early on in the presentation of primary immunodeficiency, these patients really show up not with the lower respiratory. So what you may be seeing is a patient early on with an early manifestation of primary immunodeficiency and has not yet developed lung issues. So definitely can see that a person not having had any pneumonias.
And so you suggest in your paper that treating these patients early with appropriate immunoglobulin replacement, appropriate sinus surgery could help prevent these lower respiratory manifestations of the disease.
Right.
What evidence was there in your reviews about that? What led you to that conclusion in the studies?
What we did is when we looked at some of these papers, they were looking at the immunoglobulin replacement for these primary immunodeficiency papers. Several of these papers we looked at suggested higher doses administered early in the disease seemed to be more effective. And because the upper respiratory disease precedes the pulmonary disease, these authors thought it's appropriate to test these patients and really start treating them before they have problems from repeated lung infections.
And this is very parallel to the recent literature that has suggested that perhaps performing sinus surgery earlier in the disease process helps prevent later lower respiratory tract complications like asthma and lower respiratory disease. It kind of parallels those findings.
Absolutely. And, you know, who's to know? That, I guess, is a question we don't know, and it's probably difficult in this body of literature is, you know, would early endoscopic sinus surgery in this population have that same type? I would think so.
Yeah.
Based on this study, we don't have solid literature to support that, but in my opinion, I would think that would be the case. And also, endoscopic sinus surgery for some of these patients actually helps facilitate, like, saline irrigations, just the physical flushing, which can sometimes help prevent development of a bacterial sinusitis.
Well, it's really interesting work, Sandra. So really appreciate you coming on the podcast to discuss that. And I look forward to our listeners reading your article. And maybe we can have you up back on the podcast at some point to examine some future evidence that comes out based upon this.
Great. I would like to thank you, too. Hope the listeners enjoy reading the article as well.
Thanks, Sandra. I hope you have a great day, and I'll see you somewhere in the world very soon, okay?
All right. Bye.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out with Dr. Tim Smith is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. It was directed, edited, and coordinated by Joe Troiano, with voiceover by Anne-Marie Alvarez and music by Alex Ramsdell. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or the sponsors.